This podcast is brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM for short. You can find more podcasts and other resources on our website, www.acamh.org, and follow us on social media by searching ACAMH.
Hello everyone, I'm Andre Tomlin. Some of you may know me as the Mental Elf, and I'm here in Birmingham today with Lisa Bortolotti, Professor of Philosophy at the University, Kathy Prettyfoot, Research Fellow on the Perfect Project, and Sophie Stammers, Research Fellow also on the Perfect Project. Hello everyone.
Hello.
So my name is Lisa Bortolotti and I'm a Professor of Philosophy here at the University. I'm affiliated both with the Philosophy Department and the new Institute for Mental Health, directed here by Professor Matthew Bloom. So at the moment, I'm really interested in the philosophical and ethical issues that arise from mental health. My background is very much in philosophy of mind and philosophy of psychology, and that research led me to what philosophers seem to consider a paradigmatic instance of irrationality, delusions.
So my research background is in philosophy of psychology as well, like Lisa, and epistemology. So this is theories of knowledge and rationality and what it is to have a justified belief. I was drawn to the project here in Birmingham because of this common interest that I share with Lisa. Recently I've been working on stereotyping. This is explicit stereotyping, but also the unintended stereotyping that is often labelled implicit bias. On Project Perfect, I've also become interested in memories. People commonly make errors when they're remembering past events, and in my work with Lisa on the project, we've been considering how those memories could be the result of psychological and neural mechanisms that actually bring substantial benefits.
So before I joined the project, I was also pursuing research around the philosophy of mind and also philosophy of cognitive science. Similar to Kathy, I also have an interest in stereotyping and implicit cognition. So before joining the project, I was doing a PhD looking at the issues of implicit or unintentional biases. And I think these sorts of biases present lots of interesting philosophical questions. I think quite often there's a sort of assumption that they are quite fixed and very unlike other sorts of biases that we might be more familiar with, sort of the explicit prejudices. So this interest sort of led me to what I'm now doing on the project, which is looking at something called confabulation. So confabulation is when we give, or we think that we're giving, a sincere explanation of some choice or behaviour or experience, but what we say doesn't reflect the evidence and is often false. Now, this occurs often alongside psychiatric diagnosis, but also people who don't routinely experience mental distress confabulate in all sorts of scenarios. So what we're doing on the project is looking at some of the underexplored aspects of confabulation, not just how it's sometimes costly in our cognition, but also the ways in which it might be helpful and might deliver some benefits.
So Lisa, you said you're really interested in delusions, and that's work that you've done prior to the Perfect Project. The definition of delusions has changed slightly in DSM, in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, in recent years. Can you explain to our listeners what are delusions and how do they relate to possible mental health difficulties in young people?
So first of all, we should say that delusion is somehow a controversial term. Not everybody likes talking about delusions because it brings with it a sense that it's a symptom of a disorder, it is pathological. The way we use it in the project is not to signify anything that is qualitatively different from the kind of beliefs that we all have. But I just want to say that for some people who don't like the term delusion, usually unusual belief works. It's not as specific, but it certainly begins to describe what the phenomenon is. So a delusion is really a belief, someone that a person reports sincerely and very often with conviction, that is about how the world is for that person, but it happens to be different from what most other people believe. There are various examples and various types of delusions. They may differ quite widely. In one paper with Matthew Broome, we were talking about a man who thought that there was a nuclear reactor inside himself. But other delusions are much more mundane. So people may think that, their wives are having an affair, and actually they have no particular strong evidence to suggest that. But they are convinced that that's the case. And also something quite typical of delusion, they take up all of your resources. You become a little bit fixed on the delusion, obsessed with it. It's something that you're not thinking about from time to time, but something that tends to dominate your attention. Typically, and again, that's not always the case, the delusion also has bad implications on your good functioning and well-being. So people with delusions tend to have other symptoms, maybe, of mental distress. They do not sleep well, typically. They find it difficult to continue their studies or to keep their jobs. And they tend to have difficulties with relationships as well, partially because the other people around them tend to stop believing in what they're saying. And so there is some kind of social isolation that is created by the phenomenon of delusions. People do not agree on how delusions are formed. So to some extent, we still don't know. There are some dominant hypotheses, and there are good arguments for them, but it's not really clear why we get delusions, what the process is in all the details. So in the definitions, what you find is what we call surface features, which is just how the phenomenon manifests itself, how it is that you recognize someone as having a delusion, rather than the theory behind it. So, for instance, delusions are defined in the DSM that you mentioned as beliefs that go against most of the evidence. And they're quite unique, idiosyncratic to the person who is reporting them. In my previous research, what I was interested in is exactly this type of definition that focuses on how the delusion manifests. Because when you listen to these definitions, there is really nothing that seems to distinguish the delusion as a symptom of a pathology to lots of other irrational beliefs that we all have. For instance, prejudice beliefs about people of a certain race or people of a certain gender, or superstitious beliefs about, doing much better in the exam if I wear my lucky jumper. Some people may agree with us that, a certain superstitious belief or a certain prejudice belief is true, but definitely it doesn't seem to be robust evidence for it. And most importantly, we are very resistant to giving them up. Even scientists have superstitious beliefs, even if they conflict quite widely with other things that they should believe. My research was about bringing to the fore the continuity, the similarity between delusion and other irrational beliefs that we all have in the general population. With PERFECT, we're going one step forward. With a new project, what we're looking at is recognizing and acknowledging the delusion are, psychologically and also from the point of view of acquiring knowledge of the world, quite a negative phenomenon. But at the same time, asking the question, does the adoption of the delusional belief have any benefit for me? So at the psychological level, and also at the level of allowing myself to interact with the environment around me at a time where already a crisis is going on. So some psychologists say it very nicely. They say maybe delusion is not the problem, it's the beginning of the solution. So we were exactly asking this question in the project. Is it possible that there are some positive sides to delusions, as counterintuitive as it may be, because we don't want to romanticize or trivialize people suffering. People with delusions tend to suffer. But at the same time, if there are positive roles, we need to talk about them, because this will create a much more balanced view of the experience that people are having. And this is what we're doing.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to think a bit about hallucinations, visual hallucinations, hearing voices. How do they relate to delusions?
No, that's a very interesting question that we have been asking as well. So it seems as if very often delusion come together with hallucinations of some form. Although the presence of hallucination is by no means sufficient for pathology or a clinical condition. In the general population, all forms of hallucinations are very common and, in general, not a reason for concern. But there are cases in which the belief, for instance, the delusional belief, seems to feed on a certain type of hallucination. So there is this interesting relation that sometimes the auditory experience can be part of the reason why people come up with a delusional explanation, but it doesn't need to be the case.
And you spoke about how common delusions are and how common hallucinations are. How common are they?
So it depends how you use the words delusion and hallucination. This is a typical philosopher's response, isn't it? Not very satisfying. But so delusions as a clinical phenomenon is not very common, but there are a lot of similar beliefs that we all have and we all experience.
And I know, looking at kind of Helen Fisher's work on psychosis and symptoms in younger people, we know that they are very common. So the, one of the statistics is that 1 in 10 children will experience psychotic symptoms, such as hearing voices. But that doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to go on to have a mental health disorder. So what's the relationship, do you think, between these psychotic symptoms and later mental illness?
It seems as if risk factors are really of a diverse nature. But the most striking to me is really about being in an environment which is an urban environment rather than a rural environment, surprisingly, and being in a situation where you may not be, you may be an immigrant or someone at the periphery of society. So very recent immigrant or anyway ethnic minority or someone who experienced trauma, as it happens often to refugees who have escaped zones of conflict and have seen quite a lot of horrors in their early life. Those are all quite powerful risk factors. So in people who have these kind of situations in the background, then maybe the role of hallucinations and unusual beliefs may be more problematic and needs to be monitored more closely. But in general, you're absolutely right that the presence of unusual beliefs and hallucinations doesn't tell us that they will go on to develop psychosis. There is a lot that can be done to prevent that, even if that looks like the route that is, you know, is in front of them.
Sophie, confabulation is your specialist subject. And you defined it as an explanation that does not reflect the evidence, which I think is a really interesting definition. Twitter is full of confabulation. But in the context of young people, is confabulation a widely observed practice? And what are the risks and benefits of filling in the gaps in this way?
Sure. So I think confabulation has been shown to arise in all levels of the population, so young people included. So to give you an example, at least, of just confabulation that isn't associated with mental distress. So Jeffrey Cohen, who's a social psychologist based in the US, ran a study in which participants who were Americans indicated their support for political policies. Now, when judging the content of the policy alone, conservative participants supported stringent welfare policies and liberal participants tended to support generous ones. Now, that's obviously to be expected. However, the study authors then presented conservatives with some policies that they were told were supported by Republicans. And these policies, in fact, were generous welfare support policies. And they also presented some liberals with policies that they were told were supported by Democrats, but in fact they were quite stringent welfare policies. Now what we see is that the people who identified as conservative in this situation ended up actually supporting the more generous welfare policies, and the same way with those who identified as liberal ended up supporting the more stringent welfare policies. And when you ask them to explain their support, they don't cite this frame effect, as we call it. There is this frame effect going on, but people don't acknowledge it. Rather, what they're doing is confabulating, because they're telling us a story that sounds plausible, but we know that it doesn't track the real reasons that influenced those choices. Confabulation has been studied as a symptom, again, in relation to a mental health crisis. So, for example, a person with Alzheimer's might confabulate, for instance, about long past relatives still being around, and they might use this idea to explain their behaviour. For instance, why they're making so many cups of tea. Oh, it's because their parents are around and they're making cups of tea for those parents. So as mentioned, I think confabulation is something that we see in all walks of life. It seems to be sort of tied up with the way that our brain processes information, the way that we share information, and children obviously being owners of brains, though some parents might disagree, are also susceptible to this effect. We do see actually in very young children, they might be even more prone to confabulate I think there were some studies that suggest that actually very young children show some similar patterns of memory deficits as people with frontal lobe damage. And this just might be because the frontal lobes are kind of relatively late areas of cortical development. But anyway, there was a study from psychologist Stephen Chechi, and he demonstrates that if you repeatedly ask preschool children whether or not events that never happened to them in fact did happen, this can actually have an effect where the children start to agree that those events did happen after all. So in this study, researchers first interviewed the parents to determine kind of what the truthful life events were of the children involved. And then they also discussed with children events that they knew had never happened. So for example, kind of made up holidays or particular injuries or deaths of pets, all of this sort of stuff. Now, not only did the preschool children begin to agree that these false events actually indeed did happen to them, as the conversation went on, they actually started to embellish their stories with further details. And the study authors suggest that it was actually the stories became quite highly plausible and included lots of details that one could be fooled into thinking actually this really did happen. So I think this has some important consequences, especially when we're thinking about interviewing children in witness context. So first of all, I think it's really important that we don't use leading questions. And also, it seems to be the case that we ought not to ask repeated questions, because that's where we see the effects of confabulation begin to grow.
So there's research there that shows if suggestions are made on particular topics, then children will run with that potentially. Are there examples of children just coming up with it themselves in research papers?
Yeah, so this is what we call spontaneous confabulation. So this is where, rather than what's being measured is response to a question or response to a task, you're just coming up with the confabulated idea yourself.
And can we talk a little bit about confabulation in the context of youth mental health conditions? I'm, you know, wondering about ADHD or anxiety or eating disorders. Are there particular conditions where this is a really common symptom?
So I think confabulation arises often when there are troubling experiences or distressing experiences. So one diagnosis that's often given where something like confabulation is going on is schizophrenia. I mean, even that as a diagnosis is kind of questionable, because I think you can tick off a whole range of symptoms and be given that diagnosis and have a completely different set of symptoms yet also be given that diagnosis. So I don't kind of use that term without mentioning that scepticism I have, but of course it's useful for some people. But what's going on there, I think, is that confabulation, I mean, so lots of people think that confabulation is a primary symptom of a mental health disorder in this sort of case, but part of what we're doing on the project is to try and get people to pay more attention to, I guess, the particular content of sometimes what it is the person's confabulating about. And I think we'll sometimes see that confabulation is used in a way to make sense of quite distressing and disparate experiences. And so it's not just the case that what that person is doing is offering an explanation which is based on evidence. It might well be to them that what they're saying actually is very meaningful and is very personally significant, and it's a way to make sense of what's going on in their experiences.
Maybe another aspect of confabulation that Sophie was already hinting at is the secondary confabulation. So this is when you may just use confabulation as a way to respond to a challenge. So suppose you have just expressed a belief that other people do not share, and people challenge that. And what the person does then is reply to the challenge by expressing some other beliefs that are used as arguments in favor of their way in which they see the world. And this is used in young people, but also in older people, for instance, people with dementia. When they're challenged, "Oh, but your mother died long time ago," they say, "No, but I went for a walk with her yesterday." And this is a mechanism that really suggests what Sophie was talking about, that confabulation is very much part of how we interpret reality and also how we interact with other people. Sometimes when we have quite a strong conviction in a belief that we have, even if other people see that belief as a symptom of mental distress, the mechanism that confabulation allows to tap onto is to try to hang on to the belief by offering some potential reasons why the other person may see that you've got a point, that you know that there is something there. And so if we are considering secondary confabulation as well, I think that is very widespread in a number of different psychiatric diagnoses, but also in other aspects of everyday life.
So, Kathy, we've discussed delusions, we've discussed confabulation. Your work is focusing on memory errors. Just tell us how that relates to what we've discussed already so far.
Okay, so it seems clear that people often misremember the past. So this isn't forgetting details about the past, this is remembering something about the past, but remembering it falsely. A memory error like this would be found in cases of suggestive police questioning. So Sophie previously mentioned this. So if a police officer provides some information whilst questioning an eyewitness, say, about a crime, then that information that's provided by the police officer can be taken on board by the eyewitness, and they can end up misremembering what they actually experienced about the crime in a way that's consistent with the information provided by the police officer. So cases like this, where there are memory errors, seem to be deeply problematic, and they've been discussed a lot within psychology and legal theory. They've been used to undermine eyewitness testimony, and people like Elizabeth Loftus have famously argued that eyewitness testimony should be given less credibility as a result of these sorts of errors. But actually, we've found that errors of this sort, which are commonplace amongst the general population, can be associated with the mind operating in ways that are beneficial. So in a bad case, someone might take false information provided by a police officer and form a false belief about what they experienced about a crime. But in a good case, a person might be provided information by a peer after they've experienced an event, and they might update their existing beliefs in response to this information provided after the event. So there is a challenge here to what people ordinarily think about memory errors. So one obvious response to memory errors is to think, oh, okay, so if someone's made an error, that shows that they're unreliable, maybe incompetent, that they shouldn't be trusted. But we found actually that errors can often be the result of minds working in useful ways, so they don't have to demonstrate these negative features. In fact, they can show that someone's just got a really well-operating ordinary memory system. This is useful when you make a comparison between the non-clinical population and the clinical population, so perhaps people who've been diagnosed with a mental health condition which has memory errors related to it. Because one thing that you might do is that you might see memory errors in that population and stigmatise members of that population because they have this feature that makes them different to other people. They have this feature of being unreliable, remembering things in ways that it's not accurate or true. But once you realise that this is commonplace, that people make these sorts of errors, then this difference isn't there anymore. There's a commonality between the clinical and the non-clinical population, and this takes something of the edge off any stigma that results from noticing the difference.
There's something about the trauma-informed care approach to severe mental illness that is very fundamentally, you know, picking up on that, I suppose, saying that if somebody experiences traumatic events, false memories of that event are just a very natural way of protecting yourself from it. Kind of plays into that really nicely, doesn't it?
Yeah, it fits nicely with the idea and shows that what's happening in those sorts of cases is can not only be seen as an adaptive response, but also a response that isn't so different to the response that other people would ordinarily have in their ordinary everyday experience.
So there's a really clear kind of message here about it. This plays into stereotyping of individuals and stigmatising of individuals with mental illness. Can you kind of expand on that a little bit for us?
And this is something that I've done quite a lot of research on, particularly the way that people misperceive those individuals who they stereotype. So I take stereotyping to mean having any belief or automatic response to an individual that associates them with traits in virtue of their social group membership. So stereotyping can involve racist beliefs or sexist beliefs or beliefs about people with mental health conditions which associate them with certain characteristics or traits as a result of them having membership of a particular group. So We often focus on how it's morally wrong to stereotype, how it's morally wrong to associate individuals who are part of a social group with characteristics in virtue of their social group membership. But here on Project Perfect, we're more interested in many cases in the epistemic dimensions of these sorts of psychological phenomena. So this is a way that things like stereotyping beliefs can lead to errors, false beliefs, irrational responses to situations and misperceptions. In my research, I've explored the conditions under which these sorts of misperceptions follow as a result of the application of a stereotype. And one intuitive thing to think is that we only make errors when we stereotype, and the stereotypes are wrong, when they're inaccurate, when they don't reflect reality. That if a stereotype reflects reality, then applying it's going to be useful. One thing that's often said in discussions of stereotyping is that we always stereotype. We have to stereotype to navigate our way around the environment. How are we going to identify the doctor in the A&E department if you don't assume that the person wearing scrubs is going to be the doctor? So you have to engage in stereotyping in order to navigate your social environment. So what's the difference between the good cases where it's okay to stereotype and the bad cases where it's bad? One intuitive thought is that the bad cases are just those ones where the stereotype that's applied is inaccurate. Women are actually underrepresented in the sciences. So there's a sense in which the stereotype associating scientific expertise with men is accurate, it reflects reality, and yet it can have a distorting effect on the way that we perceive individuals. So if we apply this to the case of mental health, there are numerous stereotypes associated with mental health conditions. People with mental health conditions are associated with dangerousness, incompetence, laziness. So when these stereotypes are applied to individuals, they're often misperceived. They can be misperceived as dangerous when they're not. And if they display behaviour, for example, they might turn up late to a meeting, they might be seen as incompetent or unreliable. And really what happened was their train was late. This can happen to anyone, and it's not a feature of them that explains this. It's instead their situation. So the application of a stereotype can lead to misperception. There are particular groups that are more likely to be misperceived, it seems. So because there are particular groups that are more likely to be stereotyped. One thing that feminist epistemology has taught us is that there are members of certain groups who don't have power, who are often stigmatised and marginalised, and they can be particularly vulnerable to other people stereotyping them.
Which groups are you thinking?
So often women are discussed, particularly women who are members of minority groups, but it's clear also that people with mental health conditions could fall into that category, especially young people with mental health conditions, where they're particularly likely to be treated as if the information they're provided isn't reliable. So one thing that is often discussed within feminist epistemology is that people can be given less credibility than they deserve as a result of stereotyping. And so this could happen to people like young mothers, for example, who are treated as if they are unreliable, erratic perhaps, because they've behaved in this way that's ended up getting them pregnant. And they can then be... when they try to provide information about their situation, they can be undermined as a result of stereotypes operating that lead them to not be credible. You can see how the operation of stereotypes like this could actually worsen a person's mental health. A young person is trying to explain that they're in a bad situation, but people aren't listening to them. This could worsen their mental health.
Particularly if it's compounded by the way that group is represented in the media and in welfare policy, etc., etc. Yeah, absolutely. So all of this leads on to this fantastic quote that I don't know whether I got this out of a video that you did, Lisa, or whether this is from a paper, but you say, these factually erroneous cognitions and thoughts give philosophers the opportunity to challenge the stigma of mental illness. That sounds so cool, but what does that mean exactly?
Legitimate question, certainly. Yes, so I think that our project has real potential for undermining some of the foundations of stigma, especially when it is applied to mental health. One of the reasons why I think so is because of the picture that we're trying to sketch for you today is a picture of continuity. So we don't think that any particular symptom of mental distress shows that the person who exhibits the symptom is fundamentally different from people who do not exhibit the symptom. People with delusions have unusual beliefs that behave just in the same way as prejudiced beliefs, as superstitious beliefs, as the beliefs of an obstinate scientist who doesn't want to give up his theory even if the evidence seems to be against him. Similarly, hallucinations or unusual experiences are extremely common, and they do not need to lead to any behavior that is objectionable in any way. And confabulation is not only a practice that is extremely widespread in the population, but has a lot of benefits. Shows that we have the capacity to build narratives, to interpret the world, to make it our own, and to project ourselves into the future, which is very important. If we're thinking about ourselves not as atoms in the present, but as agents who need to be able to plan in the future and to have values and preferences and desires that pull them forward. So that's the first idea. Because the characteristics of what are considered to be symptoms of psychiatric disorders are not themselves qualitatively different from the experiences, the beliefs, the narratives that we all participate in, then it seems as if the foundations or stigma associated with people who have mental health distress should be challenged in the strongest way. But there seems to be also another message. So we have been looking at whether these so-called symptoms have positive features, whether they are not responses to trouble that the person is experiencing rather than trouble themselves. And I think in many of these cases, that's what we have found. The talented musician who becomes quadriplegic and the next day comes to think that he just got married with his girlfriend when his girlfriend had dumped him because of his accident. Is that a delusional belief? Yes, it's persistent, it is insensitive to evidence. But in that moment, his clinical team thought that that was a very important belief for him to have, because it was in a moment in which he had lost his future aspirations. He could no longer be a musician. He had lost his ability to interact with the environment that he knew about. He gave him the strength to put up with the very long rehabilitation process that he was engaging in. And funny enough, once he left hospital, he was able to live independently in his own apartment. Gradually, his delusion faded. Not all delusions operate that way, but I think that shows us that they may have this adaptive feature, this protective feature. I believe in reality not as it is, but as I want it to be, because in this moment it's necessary for me to do so to survive, not to succumb to depression or to the paralysis of action. And I think you can run that kind of argument with the other things that we've been talking about. In confabulation, in dementia, even if I have one memory that is distorted and I keep repeating all the time, and maybe I'm a bit inconsistent with, and people stop maybe listening to me, but that memory is important because the kernel of truth that Kathy was talking about, that is in that memory, is what I'm hanging on to. It's a little bit of me that I still can share with others. So that's the other aspect, I think, of the project that really challenges stigma. There are positive aspects in all of these manifestations of distress. That doesn't take anything away from the suffering that people have when very often exhibit these symptoms. I mean, we don't want to deny, you know, that their experience is very often disruptive and traumatic and that they need help. But the positive aspect makes us see things in perspective. And what we need to pay particular attention to, as Kathy noticed, is when the reasons for stereotyping someone overlap. And one person may be stereotyped for many different reasons, because they have a mental health issue, because they are a woman, because they are a young mother, and so on. And when that happens, as Kathy and Sophie were noticing, it is the stigmatization, it's the stereotyping that causes further mental health problems and worsens mental health outcomes. And that stereotyping, nobody is immune from. It's all of us, it's family members, it's friends, but unfortunately, healthcare professionals as well. And so that's what the project is trying to do by making us more aware of the existence of this stereotyping and the fact that they are not founded on any good theoretical basis. He also started proposing new ways of operating so that the stereotyping may have less of an effect on people's interactions.
Really, really interesting and fascinating, and good luck with it.
Thank you for coming.
This podcast was brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM for short.